the 19th study of the Book of Revelation, held at the Enfield Ecclesial Hall on the 9th of March 1976. Brother John Knowles speaking to the subject, the sealing of the 144,000, and the reading, Revelation chapter 7. Hymn number 137.
Thank you.
Brother John has asked that we should read together from the Book of Revelation, chapter 7. Reading together, Revelation, chapter 7. And after these things, I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree. And I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God, and he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, "Hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads." And I heard the number of them which were sealed, and there were sealed 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel. Of the tribe of Judah were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Reuben were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Gad were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Asher were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Nephilim were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Manasseh were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Simeon were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Levi were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Issachar were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Zebulun were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Joseph were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Benjamin were sealed 12,000. After this I beheld, and lo, a great multitude, which no man could number, of all the nations and kindreds and people and tongues, stood before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes and palms in their hands, and cried with a loud voice, saying, "Salvation to our God, which sitteth upon the throne, and unto the Lamb." And all the angels stood round about the throne, and about the elders, and the four beasts, and fell before the throne on their faces, and worshipped God, saying, "Amen, blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be unto our God for ever and ever. Amen." And one of the elders answered, saying unto me, "What are these which are arrayed in white robes, and whence came they?" And I said unto him, "Sir, thou knowest." And he said to me, "These are they which came out of great tribulation, and have washed their robes, and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore are they before the throne of God, and serve him day and night in his temple. And he that sitteth on the throne shall dwell among them. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more, neither shall the sun light on them, nor any heat. For the Lamb, which is in the midst of the throne, shall feed them, and shall lead them unto living fountains of waters. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes." We will now ask Brother John to lead us, speaking to the subject, the sealing of the 144,000. Thank you, Brother John.
Dear brethren and sisters, dear young people, we welcome you all back to the commencement of the class again this year, both to those who are present and also to those who are perhaps listening at home who aren't able to get here. We're going to start off our class this evening by doing a very brief review of the study of the apocalypse as we've seen it so far. And to do that, I'm going to project up onto the screen some overhead transparencies which I've prepared. For those who are listening at home on the tape, we apologise in a twofold sense. One, you won't be able to see them, and two, I understand from Brother Harold Smith that this machine over here makes a dreadful noise on the tape recorder. So I'm very sorry about that, but we'll get it over and done with just as quickly as we can. But I thought it would be a good opportunity at this stage to review the theme that we've endeavoured to establish so far in the apocalypse. I don't intend to try and go over the expository material, but certainly to have a look at what we would style the thematic approach. Now, the chart which we've got up on the screen here to start with, for those who can't see it, is actually the very first chart which is found in Volume 1. It's entitled A Thematic Outline of the Apocalypse. And for those who may not be able to see the chart but actually have it in the notes, you'll find it is opposite page 1 of Volume 1. Now, what we've endeavoured to do on this particular chart is to set out what we have styled a thematic outline of the apocalypse. There are various ways that we can look at the apocalypse. We can take it historically, we can endeavour to take it chronologically, which is somewhat difficult. We can divide it up into groups of sevens and all sorts of things like that. But I've endeavoured as much as possible to allow John to suggest his own divisions. And those who were at the class last year will recall that we suggested that John tells us when he is introducing a new section of the apocalypse. And he does that by the use of such phrases as, after this I looked, after these things I saw, after this I beheld, after that I looked, and so forth. In other words, like such books as Ezekiel, Daniel, the Apocalypse and others, when John wishes to introduce a new vision, he says, after that I turned around and I looked, I saw, I beheld, or whatever it may be. Now, when we take all of the occurrences of this phrase in the book of Revelation, we find that these parallel strips present to us what are John's own divisions in the apocalypse. Consequently, we find that the first division is chapters 1 to 3, and that sounds quite logical, because chapter 1 is the introductory chapter, the basic vision of the Son of Man, which sets the foundation for the whole of the book. And stemming out of that, we have the letters in chapters 2 and 3, which, drawing on the basic vision of chapter 1 and using the various facets of the description of the Son of Man, uses each one of these as a title to introduce the seven letters. And based upon that particular facet of the character of the Son of Man, so the letter to that ecclesia is based upon the title of the of the Son of Man used to introduce the letter. When we come to chapter 4 and verse 1, we find that we come to our first phrase, after this I looked. And on this occasion we are then introduced to the rainbow throne. That particular vision goes from chapter 4 verse 1 to chapter 6 verse 17. It's an important vision, and we would say again that if you're going to go wrong in understanding the revelation, this is the point at which you are mainly going to start to go wrong. I say mainly because you could even go wrong in chapter 1. But chapter 4 really sets the time for us. It is the time when there is one sitting on the throne with the rainbow round the throne. And I'm quite satisfied myself, and I hope by this stage you are too, that the rainbow around the throne very clearly defines the time setting for us, because the only time in the symbolical sense in the Bible that you can have a rainbow is when the Sun of Righteousness is shining, when the rain is coming down upon the mown grass, and when the clouds fading off into the distance form the backdrop for the spiritual rainbow. Hence, it has to be a vision of the establishment of the kingdom, not a vision of something going on now or at some time in the past. This then brings us to the section that we are going to look at this evening, and this is what we're styling the vision of the 144,000. Now, you will notice as we read through Revelation chapter 7 this evening that we got one of these after this expressions in verse 1, and we got another one in verse 9. So if our supposition is correct, and I feel that what we're going to see this evening will show it is correct, then the next section of the apocalypse simply goes from chapter 7 verse 1 through to verse 8. And that's a section in itself. but that the next section goes from chapter 7 verse 9 right through to chapter 15 verse 4. Now my first reaction to this was, oh Noel, you've got to be wrong, because that incorporates the trumpets, the vision of the rainbowed angel, the vision of Revelation chapter 14 with the three angels going up, all of that one vision. In fact, yes, it is. It is most definitely one vision, the main part of which is the seven trumpets. So whilst the seven seals was the main part of chapters 4 to 6, the seven trumpets becomes the basic vision of chapter 7 verse 9 to 15 verse 4, and then going briefly on to the rest of the chart that we don't want to deal with at length at this stage, we then have the seven vials from chapter 15 verse 5 to 17 verse 8, the judgment on Babylon from chapter 18 verses 1 to 24, and the final section, the New Jerusalem, chapters 19 to 22. So those divisions then, based upon John's own statements, that after he had seen that, then he turned and he looked to see something else. Now the next transparency that I'm going to put up is really the same thing again, but expressed just in a slightly different way, which you may find a little easier to follow. We'll take it in several bites so that we can see it as clearly as possible. What I've done here is I've set the same chart out, but I've simply put it down in chapter order, and I've varied the colours of the letters, and I've also expressed it in different words. So I will read this out, because this chart is not found in the notes. I've entitled it Unfolding Themes in the Apocalypse. So the first section is chapter 1, which we've styled the Foundation Vision, the Multitudinous Son of Man. So I think most of us should be fairly clear with that point at the moment. But still in the same section, we have chapters 2 and 3, letters of exhortation based on the foundation vision. See then how that is based on that. Chapters 2 and 3 based on chapter 1. We then come to the next section, which I've coloured here in brown. Chapters 4 and 5 present to us a vision of the rainbow throne set in the heavens. The theme being, worthy is the Lamb. I've written some little letters over here in yellow, which are very faint, and I'm not going to say much about them just at the moment, but it's going to be virtually the main theme of our study later on this evening when we get on to chapter 7. And by that, I've put Passover. Now, I haven't hinted at that, really, I don't think, at this stage. If I had, I hadn't meant to, but I don't think I mentioned anything about it in the classes last year. I was saving it for this class. So if you care to write Passover down there, you are at liberty to simply write it in pencil, because you could quite rightly claim that you haven't been convinced of it as at this stage. So I'm going to suggest that there is a very definite Passover theme found in this section, chapters 4 and 5, and then the vision of chapter 6, which is the sequel to the opening part of the vision of chapters 4 and 5, is the sealed scroll. The Lamb commences his work by judging pagan Rome. Just tell me if that goes out of focus. It's apparently vibrating down a little bit now and again. I have to keep adjusting it. If I forget, you just tell me, will you? That brings us then to this next section, which is the chapter we read this evening, chapter 7, verses 1 to 8. This is the vision of the 144,000 sealed ones, the first fruits unto God. And naturally, I put alongside of that in yellow, first fruits. The next vision is chapter 7, verses 19 to 17. Now, this is the first part of the next main section, which you can see is all in black down here. And it's the one that goes right through to chapter 15, verse 4. So chapter 7, verses 9 to 17, is the vision of the numberless multitude with palms and white robes. And I've put alongside of that in yellow, tabernacles. And so you will see there, Passover, first fruits, and tabernacles. The first fruits, of course, is also associated with Pentecost. So the follower of the law study will quickly recognise there the three major feasts in the Jewish year. And I'm going to suggest a bit more about that later on. Chapters 8 and 9 are the seven trumpets, the judgments on Catholic Rome. Chapter 10, which we generally style the vision of the rainbowed angel, I've styled here the culminating judgments on Catholic Rome. Now, at this stage, I'll just stop while you're perhaps catching up and writing a few of these things down. You might be able to begin to see the pattern now. I've often wondered, and I no doubt a lot of other people have wondered, why a vision like chapter 10 suddenly appears sort of in the middle of the book. Now, you know the vision of the rainbowed angel comes in with one foot on the sea and one foot on the earth, and the judgments go out. And then you come back to chapter 11, which is all about the French Revolution. Why go right forward and then come back? And then by the time you get to chapter 14, you get almost the same vision as chapter 10 again. Well, the answer is that chapter 10 is the culminating judgments on Catholic Rome, the seven trumpets, you see, introducing the judgments on Catholic Rome. We haven't studied that yet, so don't worry about the details. We then go on to chapter 11, which presents to us another parallel theme. Something that's going on in another part of the world, while the events of chapters 8 and 9 were going on in yet another part of the world. In other words, it's parallel events. But rather than superimpose them on the one chapter, the Spirit has seen fit to divide them. So chapter 11 I've styled the two witnesses, contemporary developments in the Western Empire. So whilst the seven trumpets were the judgments on Catholic or universal Rome, the two witnesses are the contemporary developments in the Western Empire. Chapters 12 and 13, the dragon and the beast of the earth, contemporary developments of Christendom. Christendom being a new system which you can't define geographically, but which is now the Roman system. I'll call it the Roman Catholic system, but I'm not happy to call it Catholic because I've used the word Catholic up here in a different sense of the term. I use the word Catholic in the sense of universal, which is what the word Catholic means. Anyway, I'm not trying to expound that at this stage. So chapters 12 and 13, the dragon and the beast of the earth, contemporary developments of Christendom. So that when we come to chapter 14 to chapter 15 verse 4, where we have another chapter where Christ returns and pours out the judgment, and we say that's almost the same as chapter 10, the answer is that the difference between chapter 14 and chapter 10 is that whereas chapter 10 was the culminating judgments on Catholic Rome, chapter 14 is the culminating judgments on Christendom, which was spoken about in chapters 12 and 13. So naturally, it's talking about the same sort of thing. But when one gets down to details, obviously the details are different. And then that brings that section to an end. Now maybe even at this stage you can begin to see why we were right in assuming that that is a complete section which goes from chapter 7 verse 9 right through to chapter 15 verse 4. It's all part of a series of events which are going on in different places at the same time, but which will ultimate in two judgments, the judgments on Christendom and the judgments on Catholic Rome. But in fact, these will all involve the return of Christ. And many of them will be similar events, if not the same event. So it's natural that there are some similar things in chapters 10 and 14, and yet some different things. Right, that brings that section to an end. We come then to the next group, which is simply chapter 15, verse 5, through to chapters 16 and 17. And that section, simply the seven vials, judgments on papal Rome. We come then to chapter 18, the next section, culminating judgments on Babylon, which is papal Rome. So whilst that brown section there deals with the seven vials, the judgments on papal Rome, chapter 18 is the culminating vision of the judgments on Babylon. Like we had back there, remember? The seven trumpets were there, then we had the culminating judgment. The dragon and the beast there, Christendom, the culminating judgment. The seven vials here, the culminating judgment. And then finally, the vision which goes from chapters 19 to 22, the final vision, the time of glory, the millennium and beyond. Now, if you've managed to get a copy of that, that I hope will be one of the clearest references which I've given you since the class started on the structure of the apocalypse. It's of course the same as that previous one which we showed you in the notes, but it's setting it out in just slightly different words. Now, once again, let me say, don't worry if you haven't grasped this down here. Naturally, we haven't dealt with it, but simply keep it for future reference and see how we get on as we progress. How are you going with copying that? Have you just about got it all down? If you're still looking down, I'll assume you're still copying. There's still one or two looking down. Well, okay, I'll slip that up to the top of the screen so I can in fact keep talking. Tell me to stop when I've gone too far. Right. Yep. I've got to hold it there too. Now, if you want a simplified structure, this is a simplified structure of the chart which was there before. The basic part of the apocalypse consists of the seven seals, the seven trumpets, and the seven vials. So if on your previous chart you cared to sort of just underline the seven seals, the seven trumpets, and the seven vials, that is the main structure, with the other visions being sort of complementary to what's going on there. And the reason we know they are the main visions is because each one's separated by an earthquake. There's the three earthquakes in the apocalypse: the earthquake between the seals and the trumpets, the earthquake between the trumpets and the vials, and the other earthquake down off the corner, which you can't quite see just at the moment. Okay, for that first one? Anyone missed out on it? You can read it up here if you like. Right? Okay. You can get it afterwards anyway. I'll leave it out the front there. Well, there we are. That would be what we might style the simplified structure of what we have said. We've already looked at the seals, which, as we've said, are God's judgments on pagan Rome from 96 to 324 AD. We then have the trumpets, God's judgments on Catholic or universal Rome. You know how the nations of Europe came down and invaded Rome, and Rome got taken back up into Europe. You know, you've heard the story of Daniel's image and the ten toes. The ten toes were European Rome. Well, that's the sort of Catholic Rome that I'm talking about. The Catholic Rome that lasted until 1790, till the time of the French Revolution. And then following that, we then have all that's left of Rome now is what can be styled papal Rome. It's no longer a universal Rome. It's not, strictly speaking, a pagan Rome. And yet there is an element of truth in saying that there's a bit of paganism in it, there's a bit of Catholicism in it, and there's a lot of papal belief in it. So that when Christ comes, he will actually, of course, judge all of those phases of Rome, because they will, in fact, be culminated in this last one. One or two are still copying there. Is there any quick question about any of those chapters? Is there something you couldn't read or didn't quite get? Might like the opportunity just to ask. Now, I think if you take those two chapters, particularly that previous one I gave you, and have a good look at it, and I would like you to look at it very critically. It's not something I've copied out of another book. Not saying that because I'm proud of the fact that I've invented something new. It is not in any way different from what Brother Thomas has got in Eureka, but it just hasn't, in my knowledge, been set out in quite that fashion before. So I would certainly appreciate any comments you've got if you think you can improve on it or correct some error that's in there. So please don't take it as some sort of, I was going to say, papal edict that it was, you know, infallible, but I think it looks pretty sound to me, and it certainly fits in with all of the sound expositions which we have. As a matter of fact, many of the things in there are from hints which I've seen Brother Thomas pointing out in Eureka, which, surprisingly enough, he didn't seem to spell out in detail. And one of those we're going to look at length this evening. Why I've got the earthquake written there. Well, there are three earthquakes in the Apocalypse. The first one is found in Revelation chapter 6, verse 12, which is part of the sixth seal, which is the final seal there, the seventh one being the coming of Christ. The second earthquake is in chapter 11, verse 13, which is the sixth trumpet, right, associated with the sixth trumpet, which goes there. And the final earthquake is in Revelation chapter 16, verse 18, which is part of the seventh vial. So those are the three passages where the earthquakes are referred to, and which indicate major upheavals, showing to us they are the major turning points in the book. The three phases of Rome: paganism, Catholicism, and, can't find a word that ends with ism for papal, papalism, but I don't think that's the word, but that's the period. Anybody still want that? The date of the third one. Sorry, it's going to be changed. What's this beginning? Oh, the date of the third earthquake. The third earthquake is the one described in Revelation chapter 16, which will be the judgments on Babylon, which will be after Christ has returned and he has judged the Roman system then. So it will be after. It will be after actually the invasion of the land of Israel by Rome, by Russia. It will be sometime after that. But it'll be part and parcel of that whole event. So you could style that last one the return of Christ, really, in a broad sense. I'll leave that one there in case somebody wants something from that. Now, just to quickly, and I mean quickly, review what we have seen. I don't think there will be any need for you to copy many of these down at all. We've just got here the basic vision of chapter 1, and we've set out there the main characteristics of the one like the Son of Man. I don't think there's any real point in you copying these down, because it's only something which is stated in Revelation chapter 1 anyway. We've got his garment, his girdle, his head and his hairs, his eyes, his feet, his voice, and the fact that the seven stars are referred to here as a symbol of the elders of the ecclesias. Now, these characteristics here are used in chapters 2 and 3 to become the basis of the letters. We're just reminding you of that once again. We said it a little earlier. You remember the chart of the letters? Well, that reminds us of the fact that there were certain messages in the letters to the ecclesias which went both vertically and horizontally. This particular chart, which I'm projecting up at the moment, is the one that's found in volume 1 of the notes and is opposite page 14. It's the chart which is entitled A Tabular Analysis of the Seven Letters. And we would remind you at this stage that the letters, although they would read in a vertical fashion going down, we do find that there is a certain theme as we go across, as we notice a decline in the characteristics of the ecclesias. It can be seen in the words of disapproval and in the words of warning in particular. And so we felt that there was a pattern which was seen there, and there were many sober lessons which we could learn for our ecclesias today. And then finally, we remind you of the other chart which we had of the rainbow. This is a very important vision. Only recently I was discussing with somebody the so-called futuristic view of Revelation, which, although it's called futuristic, really does start back at a time prior to the kingdom. And in Revelation chapter 4, there is a view which says that the vision of the throne is something which is either going on currently in heaven or went on sometime around about the first advent of the Lord. This cannot possibly be true, because in the terms of the symbology of Revelation, we have the sun shining, we have the clouds, and we have the rain. And consequently, the formation of the rainbow needs rain, it needs clouds, and it needs the sun. The sun is the sun of righteousness, the rain is that which comes down in the day when the clouds shed their water, and the clouds as a backdrop become the mirror against, well, the screen against which the rainbow is projected. That particular chart is also found in the notes, and it is found on page 50 of the notes, which is in volume 2. Well, that brings us now to the section we're going to deal with this evening, and that is Revelation chapter 7. Is there any quick question on anything up to chapter 7 that you would like to ask, which, if you don't ask it at this stage, you may feel will hinder your understanding of chapter 7? All right, well, we'll go straight on then with chapter 7, and I intend to deal with this under three main headings this evening. We're going to look at chapter 7, verses 1 to 8. We may, in fact, be able to cover all of these 8 verses this evening, at least in the thematic sense. I'm going to deal with it under three main headings. Firstly, it will be historical. Secondly, thematic. And thirdly, exhortational. They will be the three headings, and I'm going to deal with them in that order, so that if you're taking notes, you can quite safely follow the plan that it will be, first of all, I will be looking at it from the historical angle, secondly, from the thematic, and thirdly, the exhortational. Now, looking firstly at the historical, you'll probably gather from what I've already said that I don't think that we have to place undue emphasis on the historical interpretation of the apocalypse. The historical facts are a valuable asset to us to be able to prove that our interpretation of Revelation is correct, because we are living at almost the terminal point of the visions of the apocalypse, and we can look back and prove that our interpretation has been justified. Somebody living in the year AD 100 did not have any historical facts to use to verify. Obviously then, the message which was to be conveyed to these people would have been more in a thematic and an exhortational sense. As I present the historical facts, I do so on the basis of what Brother Thomas presents in Eureka. He deals quite a bit with the historical facts there. I don't intend to deal with them to quite the same extent as Brother Thomas does. He suggests that the period which is referred to here in Revelation chapter 7 was a period of tranquility, a period of peace, from the year AD 324 to the year AD 396. You probably notice in volume 3, which I guess most of you have got at this stage, that the first of the trumpets, I'm just putting this up for reference for the moment, not to deal with it in detail, but that the first of the trumpets is in the year AD 395, or I said 396. So in the period 395-396, you've got your first trumpet. But the sixth seal ended around about 324 AD. So there is actually a break. There is this period from 324 to 395 or 396, which was a period of tranquility between the ending of the sixth seal and the commencement of the blowing of the first of what is generally styled the wind trumpets. The first four trumpets are generally styled the wind trumpets. Now, this period then, historically, from 324 to 396, was a period of peace. It was a period which, Brother Thomas says, provided the opportunity for the events described here in Revelation chapter 7 as the sealing of the 144,000. It says in Revelation chapter 7 and verse 1 that after these things I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree. So you've got these four representative angels standing at the four so-called points of the compass, controlling the four winds. And as wind is a symbol of judgment, they are restraining. They are restraining the judgments. They are restraining these events which were going to bring war upon certain parts of the earth, styled here the earth, the sea, nor any tree. They are restraining them for the time being. So it does speak of a period of peace, a period of tranquility. But in verse 2 it says, "And I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God, and he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. So it is simply saying that there would be a period in which the violence would be restrained while the work of this other angel, having ascended from the east, should complete the work of sealing the servants of our God. Now the historical interpretation tells us that this had an application during the period AD 324 to 396. With the rise of Constantine and the merger of pagan Rome with the growing power of Christianity, it appears that with the triumph of Constantine, that one could almost say that the truth could well have become extinct. That many people who had just been hanging on to the truth would have compromised it and would have thrown in their lot with the ruling system. It would have been convenient to do so. So great was this earthquake that it was probably quite a shattering blow to the few people who were tenaciously holding to the truth. And it would have been a test case, should we join with the emperor or should we not? Consequently, rather than bring any further problems on them at that immediate time, it appears that historically the Spirit provided an opportunity whereby they may have become consolidated in the truth which they held, styled the sealing of the servants of God. The other angel, which is referred to in verse 2, is styled as having ascended out of the sun's rising. You may like to have your notes actually open at this stage and glance at a few of these things. I'll look at them in more detail in a moment. But you'll notice Brother Thomas's translation of verse 2 is, I saw another angel having ascended from the sun's rising. It is the past tense. It had already ascended. Not only had it ascended from the east in a literal sense, that is, it had come from the area of the land of promise over into the west, into the area of Rome. But also, more particularly, in a symbolical sense, it had come out of a sun's rising. So the word east, the Greek word Anatole, A-N-A-T-O-L-E, Anatole, means in this place literally a sun's rising, and is so translated in many other translations. It's the same expression that we'll come across again later on in Revelation chapter 16 and verse 12, where we read that the river Euphrates was dried up, that the way of the kings out of the sun's rising might be prepared. Now, what is this sun's rising? Well, there is one other place where this word Anatole occurs, and it's a very interesting one, and that's in Luke chapter 1 verse 78.